hear of all these CEOs and startup founders that are so married to their idea of a product that it has to be perfect. And then you've spent 5 years working on a, you know, an app or a med tech device that isn't going to go anywhere because you're so focused on it to be so perfect.
Welcome to MedSider, where you can learn from the brightest founders and CEOs in medical devices and health technology. Join tens of thousands of ambitious doers as we unpack the insights, tactics, and secrets behind the most successful life science startups in the world. Now, here's your host, Scott Nelson.
Hey everyone, it's Scott. In this episode of MedSider, I sat down with Ahmed Zobi, founder and CEO of Center Health Technologies, who has a decade of experience in the medical device industry. He advises and mentors many startups, has been recognized as a Forbes Next 1000 honoree, and is a guest lecturer at the USC Keck School of Medicine. Ahmed also serves as a board member at various organizations, including the Wound Healing Society and the UCI Center for Innovation and Entrepreneurship. Here for you the key things that we discussed in this conversation. First, embrace a lean mentality, move forward with your available resources, and challenge every expense in the early days of your startup. Don't let the pursuit of perfection paralyze you, and don't waste time and money over-engineering early versions. Prototype rapidly to seek real-world feedback to guide your next steps and be prepared to pivot if necessary. Second, focus on meeting FDA's core requirements first. Don't get bogged down trying to add extra bells and whistles to early prototypes and submit as soon as you can to kickstart a productive dialogue with the agency. Even if you don't get immediate approval, their prescriptive feedback will guide your path forward. Third, VC funding might not be an option during the early days of your startup. Explore all opportunities like grants, accelerators, and any niche programs that fit your technology. When it comes to non-dilutive funding, submit strong applications early, even if they aren't perfect. And don't be afraid to cast a wide net across relevant NIH departments. And then when it comes time to approach VCs, research their portfolios and track their records. Show them how investing in you fits their specific goals and strategies. All right, before we jump into this episode, I wanted to let you know that the latest edition of MedSider Mentors is now live. We just published Volume 5, which summarizes the key learnings from the most popular MedSider interviews over the last several months with incredible entrepreneurs like Gabriel Jones, CEO of Proprio, Kirsten Carroll, CEO of Can Do Health, Dr. David Alpert, founder of AliveCor, Greg Bullington, CEO of Magnolia Medical, and other leaders of some of the hottest startups in our space. Look, it's tough to listen or read every interview that comes out, even the best ones, but there are so many valuable lessons you can pick up from the founders and CEOs that join our program. So that's why we decided to create MedSider Mentors. It's the easiest way for you to learn from the world's best medical device and health technology entrepreneurs in one central place. To check out the latest volume, head over to MedSiderRadio.com/mentors. Premium members get free access to all past and future volumes. If you're not a premium member yet, you should definitely consider signing up. In addition to every volume of MedSider Mentors, you'll get full access to the entire library of interviews dating back to 2010. You'll also be able to see all of our playbooks, which are handpicked collections of the most insightful interviews with the brightest founders and CEOs that join our program. Whether you're looking to master capital fundraising, navigate early stage development, tackle regulatory challenges, understand reimbursement, or position your venture for a meaningful exit, MedSider playbooks have you covered. And last, considering that fundraising can be one of the most daunting tasks for any startup, we created a meticulous database of investors right at your fingertips. Explore a wealth of VC funds, private equity firms, angel groups, and more, all eager to invest in medical device and health technology startups. Access to this database is a premium member exclusive, so don't miss out. Learn more about MedSider Mentors and our premium memberships by visiting MedSiderRadio.com/mentors. All right, without further ado, let's jump into the interview. All right, Ahmed, welcome to MedSider. Appreciate you coming on.
No, thank you for having me, Scott. Appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm looking at your background in beautiful Southern California, although it looks a little bit little rainy after the monsoon that came through, right? But
right, like what's funny is that so I wasn't born in California. I was born in Ohio. So when people freak out about rain, I'm like, if only you knew the winters in Ohio.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, no, I'm a fellow Midwestern guy as well on the West Coast. But yeah, it looks almost like a fall day in the Midwest, you know, behind the scenes.
It honestly is. I mean, the crazy part is when California floods, it really floods, right? Some of the freeways are gone, kind of lose your infrastructure and stuff. But I mean, I like that. I'm wearing my shirt and shorts and I have no complaints whatsoever about the temperature or the weather. Just put an umbrella up and stay dry. That's all I do.
That's right. Spoken like a true Ohio native. with that said, I recorded a very short bio at the outset of this episode, but I always like to start here. If you can kind of give us a, you know, sort of an elevator pitch for your background leading up to starting the company, that let's begin there, and then we'll kind of you know, slowly kind of go back in time and learn a little bit more about the journey.
Yeah, for sure. So my name is Ahmed Zobi. I'm the CEO of Center Health Technologies. I graduated out of UC Irvine's undergraduate program back in 2016. And we started this project out of a new program that the biomedical engineering department was doing at UCI called the BioEngine. So sort of like a copy of the Stanford Biodesign program, right? Got IP that's dusty, sitting on a shelf, doing nothing. Let's kind of, you know, create a team around it of undergrads that can breathe some new life into it. And so my background, I did a lot of research at UCI in tissue engineering, micro and nanotechnology, specifically with lab on chip microfluidics. And the rest of my team was around that area. We had an individual that was doing, one of my co-founders that was doing CD microfluidics. And ramping up to this, this was my fifth year at UCI. I took a fifth year, which I think everything happens for a reason. We found this project that, you know, was using lab on chip microfluidics, but it was having a lot of issues with leaking, implosions, you know, stuff getting stuck inside of it, you know, the machine, the device breaking. And we said, you know, we could do this a lot better. And that is how we formed Center.
That's awesome. I love these stories. Excited to dig in a little bit more detail. But we're recording this in early 24. Looks like, based on your LinkedIn profile, kind of scanning at it and looking at it as we talk live here. But did you kind of officially start the company in the fall of 15? So is it safe to say you've been at it almost almost 8 years now?
Almost 8 years. The official start date of the company itself was when we graduated. So we formed as an LLC in 2016, July of 2016. Got it. If you're talking about formation of the company, yes. And then we converted to a C Corp later on, which we'll discuss in some of the other questions that you probably have. But after we got our grant funding.
Okay.
But officially, as a team, we started in 2015 as undergrads.
Got it. Okay, cool. And then, you know, without getting too far into the weeds, because you know, we'll learn a little bit more about the technology and kind of, you know, where you've been with it since initial inception to where it's at now. But you know, what is the centrifuge system, right? Almost kind of frame this up as if I'm a, you know, freshman in high school and I know nothing about the technology.
Yeah. So the centrifuge system is a little bit of a play on words, like centrifuge, right? We all know what a centrifuge does. The centrifuge system is primarily a microfluidic channel design. So think of it as like a roller coaster ride that the tissue basically passes through. And as it's passing through these channels, whether it's big, small, tiny, square, triangle, whatever, it breaks the fat cells down. So we wanted to design a technology that automates the fat processing as altogether. Because doctors today are mainly manually processing fat tissue. And when we took on this project, we saw a huge unmet need to truly automate this process by literally pressing a button, walking away, and coming back. So the centrifuge system at its core is a fat processing tool that allows clinicians to process both small and large volumes of fat tissue in a matter of minutes.
Got it. And most of these physicians that are doing this either manually or with the centrifuge system, they're doing this to sort of harness or for lack of a better description, stem cells, right? From adipose tissue?
Not really. So the stem cells talk is mainly isolation. So under the FDA regulation, those stem cells are considered a drug. What we're doing is one step before that, right? It is breaking down these larger clusters of fat cells. So I like to explain it like, think of it as a grape on a grapevine. You're just plucking a lot of the grapes and putting them into a bowl. Still grapes, it's just you're breaking them off from the grapevine, so to say. And that's what our process does. It's breaking these fat cells from, like, you know, you can have a 5 millimeter diameter down to like a 700 micron diameter. So it's very, very micronized cells rather than extracting those stem cells. Because extracting, as I said, is defined as a drug by the FDA.
Got it. Okay. Very good. That's very helpful. And give us a sense, a high level sense for kind of where the company's at in terms of, you know, kind of the clin reg process. Are you in full on, you know, commercialization? What does it look like?
Yeah. So we got our FDA clearance. We just completed an aesthetics clinical trial for facial fat volume loss. So re-volumizing the face. The results will be coming out hopefully this year, where we have two abstracts that we're going to be presenting. We're in the process of, there's another clinical trial as well in the wound care space that we're doing, but we're starting early commercialization right now. And then we're raising our Series A, obviously, to kind of, you know, push that up and do full commercial launch.
Very, very good. And just so I understand before we get any further in the discussion, this technology, it's used by physicians in their own clinics, correct? Like this is just it's a better, faster, et cetera, sort of mouse trap around fat processing, as you mentioned earlier.
Yeah. So it works in conjunction with their current workflow. So we're not really, you know, adding too much. We're basically replacing other fat processing techniques that are out there that are more manual. And really providing an automated solution to the clinician. So, you know, clinicians have like canisters, they have other fat processing devices by leading, you know, plastic and reconstructive surgery companies, very well-known ones in the state of California. But those technologies, all they really do is mainly clean the fat. They don't really break down the fat cells. And then the breaking down process is really important, especially if you're talking about retention and take within the patient's body. You don't want to put, you know, a whole cluster of fat into an area and not be able to give it the nutrients and the blood supply that's needed in order for it to survive. So processing the fat tissue is important. And that's where the research has been showing us that it is critical for better results as well.
Okay, very good. All right, so I'm looking at the website before we kind of go back in time, step inside the old MedCenter time machine, as I like to call it. It's centerhealth.com. So center is spelled S-Y-N-T-R, centerhealth.com. We'll, of course, link to it in the full write-up on MedCenter for this particular interview with Ahmed, but centerhealth.com is the website if you don't get to that full write-up and want to jump to the site, you know, during the course of this particular episode or after the fact. So with that said, first question on the docket, right? We'll spend the next 20 to 30 minutes kind of learning a little bit more about your journey, Ahmed, building the company, as well as kind of just various sort of cross-functional hurdles that you've had to cross. And so with that said, you recently, I think, rolled out, is it the Center FPU 360, I believe, maybe? Yep. Okay, so I'm going to make a guess, probably fair guess, that this system, your latest system looks far different than you know, the initial prototypes. So thinking back kind of to your early journey, working through phases of development, you know, going from initial prototypes to alpha to beta, you know, were some key lessons learned along that way? Because this is often the most difficult thing for a lot of life sciences startups, a lot of med tech founders that are listening to this, is like they've got, you know, you've got limited capital to work with in most scenarios, and you just have to move quickly, make hard decisions, et cetera. So are there a couple of things that stand out that have been either especially helpful, you know, back then that you were able to execute against, or maybe just, you know, key lessons that you learned along the way?
Yeah, no, it's capital efficiency is critical. It's the lifeblood of a company. And, you know, they call it the lean startup methodology. I want to, after my time at Center, I'm probably going to publish a book, call it leaner startup methodology, because you can actually go leaner. You know, it's crazy because, you know, you see these tall tale signs and stories that you hear of all these CEOs and startup founders that are so married to their idea of a product that it has to be perfect. And then you've spent 5 years working on a, you know, an app or a med tech device that isn't going to go anywhere because you're so focused on it to be so perfect. That wasn't the case at Center. The case at Center was get something done quickly, do it fast, validate it, fail. What did we fail at? How do we validate it? You know, our first prototype, I kid you not, I don't want to say this because, you know, it's crazy, but one of us almost got like clipped by a piece of plastic because all we did is we had like this little spin chuck motor and we just surrounded it with pieces of like thick aluminum. So if it broke, the hope was to hit the aluminum and, you know, hey, we failed. Let's fix it. One of them, we didn't tighten it enough and it just flew off, barely missed one of my co-founders by just like a hair. But we learned from that, right? Now, obviously, do everything as safely as possible, guys. But, you know, there in ideation, there's risks, right? You got to just go at it and try to make it work. So for us, our first prototype was, not an encasement, just like this motor. And we just put our thing on it. But then it evolved. You know, we got like very thin pieces of plastic, created an encasement, had that same motor. Our first prototype was literally built for under, I would say, $400. We got like a janky used motor, you know, acrylic plastic from McMaster Car for like, God knows, $20, and just screwed this whole thing in together and created our first box. But we were able to do it so quickly. We went through, I think, 5 or 6 prototypes within a span of about a month and a half before we got our first truly like, hey, this is Gen 1 of our device. And it was done, again, relatively cheaply. You know, our first centrifuge system, what is now known today as the centrifuge system, was done for like $30, just CNC plastic. So, you know, what I tell a lot of the startups, especially the ones that I mentor through a lot of the programs that I'm a part of, is, you know, especially if you're in the med tech space, get something that works out. Don't focus so much on the perfection, because at the end of the day, your customers are going to tell you what's wrong with your product, not you. So what we did is we mixed a little bit of that, and we did a program later on, about a year later, which was called the NSF iCore program. And that's where we really got out there and started talking to clinicians and talking to the users, not even the clinicians. People think, oh, go to the, you know, the surgeon, they'll tell you everything about your product. Well, if the nurse doesn't like your product, or this, or the scrub tech doesn't like your product isn't going to be used in the OR, no matter how much the surgeon loves your product. Mm-hmm. So really understanding who your users are, who your customers are, that's critical. And that's what we did. Limited capital, we just try to get our prototypes out there as fast as possible, validate it, and then eventually push it on to whether it's federal funding or even trying to raise capital around it.
Yeah, so important, your comment around really understanding who's actually using your product, right? Because it's so easy to gravitate towards physicians, and don't get me wrong, those shouldn't be ignored, especially if you're working on a physician preference device. But you know, if nurses are touching it, if techs are touching it, like, you need to understand kind of what their feedback is.
We had early on, we had when we were doing usability studies, we had a nurse that was like, you know, we want to see A, B, and C feature added to it. And I was like, oh, shoot, I never thought about that, because the plastic surgeons or whomever is not thinking about that, because they're doing surgery.
Yep.
But it's, if the tech is looking at it, it's like, hey, man, you know, I need this type of feature to let me know what's going on or how many seconds are left. Like, yeah, the ring light works, but I really want something like this. And you're just adding and stacking more features on top that you can only get from true user understanding, not just, oh yeah, we're in the, you know, any company could say we're in the cardiology space, we're going to talk to cardiologists. Well, if your product is like tuned by the tech before it goes to the cardiologist, and you need to make sure that the product is tuned accordingly, you need to start talking to the cardiology techs, not the cardiologists. Cardiologist is implanting it. You need to talk to the dude and gal that is actually preparing it for that doctor.
Yep, 100%. No, totally agree. And your feedback around this kind of this almost like this mindset, right, of shipping as fast as possible and as lean as possible, and just getting something out there, right? I actually did a presentation earlier this morning, kind of under this guise of, like, you know, startups are like, it's like March Madness, survive in advance, right? Meaning, you know, survival meaning do as much as you can with as least amount of capital as possible to just advance to the next milestone, the next inflection point, right, in the life cycle. But that mindset, you know, it sounds like you're fairly bent towards kind of you know, startups and the entrepreneurial kind of ecosystem, but it can be very hard, right, for someone that maybe grew up in big companies and strategic. It just feels uncomfortable, you know, that they're
it is, and I've seen it for both, you know, like, I've, the biggest thing that I try to do is I try to teach young entrepreneurs that kind of mindset. You need to shift away from that, and with regards to older individuals that have been in industry, moving to a startup, like people, like, you know, you see all these jokes online, like, oh, quote unquote, what is an operator? You know, I'm an operator. And it's like, it's a person that's been in industry for 30 years, but has never actually started or run, you know, a startup. It's completely different. The path of an entrepreneur is really, really, really difficult. And, but in my opinion, I feel of it as it's being worth it, you know, to do what I do. But it's difficult, and people need to understand that you can only make it more difficult by how you set your mindset, right? If you're on this path that if I'm going to make this perfect, it's either going to fail by the time it's quote unquote perfect to you, or it's going to fail because you're going to run out of money. And that, again, is the lifeblood of a company. And even with, you know, low limited capital, right? You have to think, how can I double my runway? You know, if you got your first, you know, let's say you got into YC or any of these incubators, you got your first 150, and you know, the initial 150 is supposed to last you 6 months. You better make sure that it lasts you at least a year, right? And again, that's capital efficiency. And a lot of people are just don't understand that. You know, I've seen companies raise, you know, 10 times more than what we've raised, right? And they still haven't received FDA clearance, or they still haven't had successful clinical trials. It takes a different type to truly sit back and understand, like, hey, we need to look at this in a different way. And I think that, you know, the listeners and also the people that I mentor too can respect that, because it makes them understand that there is no rush to spending money. There's a rush to making meaningful milestones. And I think that's great.
Yeah, that's a great line that you just used. There's no rush to spending money, but there is a rush to get to the next sort of inflection point, right? Whether it's development related, whether it's, you know, clin reg related, et cetera. And this is a quote I often share. Feels like it's been a while since I've mentioned it, but you know, Dharmesh Shah is the founder of HubSpot, one of the founders of HubSpot. I remember hearing him on a podcast, you know, gosh, several months ago now. He mentioned a quote that around the fact that the best CEOs, right, that he's encountered or that he works with, et cetera, they're decision machines, right? They can make decisions decisively, quickly, and move on. And I think that's one of, I would echo that same sentiment, right?
100%.
Yeah, Dharmesh office is a lot more successful than me, but it really resonates, right? I mean, in a startup, you have to be surrounded by a group of people that are okay with making decisions when it feels uncomfortable, right? And you just got to go. You got to go. So, with that said, Ahmed, you mentioned the fact that you got FDA clearance a couple of years ago, 2021, to be more specific. Then you're working on, it sounds like, a couple of clinical publications. When you think about, you know, the last handful of years as you've kind of navigated, you know, the ups and downs of like the regulatory landscape, you know, how much budget to allocate towards clinical efforts, et cetera. And what stands out to you? How do you coach up other entrepreneurs that are kind of going through the same battles?
I think my situation is a little bit different. So with respect to what I would have liked as an optimal situation, it was COVID. You know, it was the first year of COVID, 2020. We had, I'm not going to say the amount of money left in the bank account, but not as much. And we had to make a decision: clinical trials, FDA clearance, or payroll. We cut ourselves off and we put the money towards our regulatory and our clinicals. Now, the clinicals took time. As you know, a lot of the states were not allowing, you know, any clinical trials unless maybe it was like COVID related. So it took, you know, a couple of years to get that set up and going. But we basically put, you know, we pulled an Elon, you know, SpaceX or Tesla. We did both, and we focused our efforts there. So that situation now, if you were a founder during that time and you had to make that, you know, I respect everything, and we both share, you know, a common event. Now, for other founders in a different situation, you know, it's definitely, there's a lot of people that would say go for clinical trial data and then go for regulatory. Now, for our specific FDA clearance pathway, we didn't need any clinical data. It was based on predicate, 510K class two, relatively simple. We had some things that we had to do for the FDA, and we sent that in, and we got our clearance relatively quickly. But again, it was during COVID, so, you know, EUA authorizations kind of slowed down all the other FDA clearance pathways timelines. So what would have taken 3 months, you know, to get, you probably were waiting 6 months, right? So with regards to that, you know, navigating the clinical and regulatory, I think ultimately falls upon being able to push for, you know, the balance that you really need. And the balance is really focused around, you know, especially on the regulatory side, really looking at what tests you need to be, you know, to finish, what, you know, reports you need to have for the FDA, the timelines, the worst case scenarios. Whereas with clinical trials, it's more on who you're working with. You know, so ultimately it's like, you know, which CRO do you, are you using? You know, who's the staff members that are going to be, you know, helping you out? And clinical trials are expensive. Don't get me wrong. You know, they can range in the millions. So personally for me, taking a couple step back, if you have a quick pathway through the regulatory market, my advice, this is me, obviously talk with your team and your board, right? My advice is always to just put whatever you have, complete all the studies and stuff that the FDA requires of your product. Don't add more things than is asked of you, right? And then put it up, because at the end of the day, you're locking in the FDA into a bona fide agreement, so to say. There's a contractual obligation now that the FDA has to respond to you within a certain period of time. If your application didn't get rejected straight through the door, but if it actually made it through, which thankfully ours went through the first try, you know, you're going to get a couple of responses back. You're going to get questions. You're going to get your deficiency letters, et cetera. That's now, you know, that's your pathway. Now, some people might say, hey, Ahmed, do you think I should do, you know, a pre-submission? If it's a 510K based on predicate, again, my personal thoughts, there's no point. Just go and submit. You know, you have a predicate, you do all the tests the predicate did, submit it to the FDA and see what else they want from you right then and there. But, you know, it's definitely something for companies to talk with their team and their regulatory advisor for sure about whether it's worth it to go down the pre-submission pathway. Personally, for me, I'm just, as we've discussed, just chuck it in, see what happens. And you know, there will never be a true best foot forward, so to say, because the FDA could tell you something in the pre-sub and they could still ask for more things after you've submitted. You know, it's not a guarantee. The pre-subs are never guaranteed. It's just, hey, thank you for sharing. This is what we want to see. The reviewer could end up saying, I don't like any of this, or I don't know the internal workings, but they could say, I still want to see some more stuff, right?
Yep, 100%.
But once you get your regulatory clearance, then maybe you can start doing, you know, again, there was no clinical trials required, right, for ours and maybe majority of other companies. But then you could start working with doctors on maybe doing like case studies or an open label study, right? Now you could just garner a little bit more real world data. I personally like real world data versus, you know, the expensive clinical trial, because the real world data is what doctors are going to go out there and, you know, go talk about at conferences. Yes, in certain levels of conferences, there's going to be like a scientific merit that you're going to need to meet. But, you know, at least you're a startup that's getting out there. You're getting your voices heard, you know, your product heard, your product spoken about. And then you can raise the capital really needed to, if you do need to go back and do like a comparative study against another product to show superiority to it or whatever, then that's how you do it, right? Now, again, if you're a well-funded startup, do both and good luck, you know what I mean? But for startups that are struggling to raise, you have to pick what gets you to generating revenue the fastest.
Yep.
Right.
Yep. And by getting in market, you're able to, most likely opportunities will sort of present themselves, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Your product could be the secret sauce that another product in the same field, right? Not maybe the same exact product that you're trying to compete against, but that product might need you to sell their products, right? So distribution networks might say, hey, we're going to lump these two products into one, you know, buy one, get one kind of offer or whatever combination. And they sell it to doctors and say, hey, yeah, no, so this product will do this for your patients. And then you can attach the second product to do this after your surgery or whatever it might be. You don't see that, you know, that happening if you just have the clinical. But if you have the regulatory approval, you're out there, you're working, you're hustling in the market, and you're expanding your network to distribution partners. You know, we've been approached by several that say, hey, yeah, we'd love to put your product with, you know, these product lines that we're already selling, whether it's skin cream or neurotoxins or whatever, because we're already selling those packages to doctors. Adding this one product on, it's not going to do them, it's not going to be crazier than what they're already purchasing, right? Yep. So these complementary product lines is really critical for also successful, commercialization.
Yep, no doubt. And your point about pre-subs, I think is spot on, because so many kind of purists, I guess, within the med tech space will automatically default to a pre-sub, right?
Like 100%.
We need to do it. We have to go down the pre-sub pathway, and you're dead on. I mean, not that you shouldn't consider it, right? I mean, I think it should be on the table, but it doesn't necessarily mean you have to do it. And that feedback from FDA is not binding, right? So even if there are key questions that you really want feedback from FDA around, and it makes all the sense in the world to do a pre-sub, just keep in mind, that again, that feedback is not binding, right? I mean, you're only going to really know until you submit that package,
until
right?
It's the same thing with patents, right? You won't really know until you submit your patent. It's not like you're going to have meetings with the USPTO and be like, hey, what do you think about my claim number 1 through? No, it's...
Hey everyone, let's take a quick break to catch you up on Fastwave Medical, the company I co-founded and lead as CEO. We're developing multiple intravascular lithotripsy systems, or IVL for short, for a market size of over $10 billion. So you may remember the exclusive round of capital I told you we were going to carve out for Fastwave insiders in the cardiovascular space. Well, due to the overwhelming demand, we blew through our cap in just a few weeks and had to close it down much earlier than expected. The incredibly high interest in this exclusive fundraise exceeded even our own expectations. But in retrospect, it sort of makes sense. Here's why. First, Shockwave Medical, which is the only IVL player in town, has a market cap of close to $10 billion. Second, we've designed Fastwave systems to be faster, better, and more efficient, and to disrupt this monopolized category by giving physicians more IVL options to choose from. Third, we've already secured 2 non-provisional patents from the USPTO, one of which was granted in 6 months, which is almost unheard of in the medtech space. We may open up another private fundraise in the future, so if you're interested in joining our waiting list to invest in one of the hottest cardiovascular therapies, head over to fastwavemedical.com/invest and enter your email. Again, that's fastwavemedical.com/invest. All right, let's get back to the rest of the conversation.
You create the best of claims, you submit it, it's always going to get rejected. I mean, I've only heard of like rare cases where like, oh yeah, we got it on our first try. And then I kind of like look at him like, was it because it was really narrow? Like, you kind of get that thought process, right? But if you're going for very broad claims, you almost always get rejected, and then you have the meeting with the examiner, et cetera. So, and even those meetings with the examiner, sometimes it's not really binding. It's like hey, we had a chat, we agree, we're going to modify A, B, and C here, and then it should go through, right? Thumbs up and everything goes well. But yeah, exactly. It's non-binding with the FDA. So if you're basing it off of a predicate, there's already products out there that do something called substantially equivalent to what you're doing. You just copy what they have to do for the FDA and move on, right? Mm-hmm. And again, the FDA could say, hey, yo, no, that was good, but that was like, 2006. We need A, B, and C tests done. Hey, your application's on pause to do A, B, and C tests. Go do them. And congratulations, you have a high likeliness of getting your FDA clearance after that, right? Mm-hmm. Unless they have more questions. But it's once after the tests are done, normally the questions are grammatical. You know what I mean? Like, hey, we need to change this word, or we need to do this thing. So it becomes a lot easier conversation with the FDA. So that's why personally for me, it's like, just get it done. Yep. And I tell a lot of the startups, like, even if it's an early prototype, and it does require clinical trial data for the FDA, get the data off your prototype, because as long as the design, the underlying working and mechanism of the product is the same, just because you put a new casing around the tech doesn't mean anything. Right. You could still use that data for the FDA submission. Yep. So, don't focus like, oh, well, we need it to be, super clean, nice, sleek products. Like, no, just use a janky product. If it looks okay and it works okay, gather that data, get ready to submit for the FDA, get your FDA clearance or approval, and then move forward, Then you can do your product dev afterwards. Again, getting that FDA clearance line, I think, has been something that a lot of investors are asking for. But in the med tech space, what I'm seeing a lot right now is a shift from even, as you even brought it up, early R&D phase, they're now looking for like commercialization. Mm-hmm. It's a crazy, crazy shift. So a lot of investors are probably even moving away from investing in early med tech ideas until you get your FDA clearance.
Yep.
And then we could start talking seed, series A, et cetera. So this is just advice, again, from what I've heard and what I'm seeing, even big VCs and even big big companies like even JP Morgan Life Sciences that are starting to invest in med tech later on this year is what their anticipated plan is. They're looking for commercial ready companies.
Yep.
So, you know, if you're a med tech startup CEO, you're starting right now. How fast can you get to commercialization in the most legal, ethical manner, obviously possible? You need to take that into consideration.
Yeah. Yeah. There's no doubt the goalposts have kind of been shifting for quite some time, but it's sort of accelerated. I think coming out of the 2021-22 kind of reversion. So there's no doubt a couple other things that stood out to me kind of hearing you kind of riff on this answer a bit. One was your comments around what you went through in COVID, right? That decision to basically like halt, you know, defer your comp, right? And make a really, really hard decision. And it stood out to me because I think there's probably a lot of folks that are working on startups are going through some rough times right now, challenging waters. And you may think, gosh, this is a failure, right? I'm deferring my comp. What am I working on this for? Just know that like, these stories are not atypical. You know, it's rare for someone to share it like you did, right? And be transparent about that, but it's not atypical. I mean, there's so many, I mean, I can recall like off the top, and I won't name names, you know, because I'm not sure how public these stories are, but like really, you know, startups that have really successful outcomes, right? 5 years down the road. But you know, after the fact, when people that were there early on, they're like, we almost died like, you know, 100 times.
10 times.
You know what I mean? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's like, really? I mean, you guys had a monster exit and they're like, oh no. Like it was like, you know, rocking a tightrope for like, exactly. you know, endless, exactly. Endless tightrope.
It's the 10 years overnight success story that right, people exactly. Don't really understand the relationships that have been put to test, the mental and physical, you know, just trauma through this whole process. At the end of the day, it's, again, entrepreneurship is not sunshine and rainbow. I mean, for some people, I mean, like you look at some people that are like, oh yeah, we started our company last week and we've raised, you know, $30 million and it's an AI company. You know, like put those people aside, right? Like you brought up a really good point, Scott. It's the untold stories, right? Mm-hmm. Which honestly, if you were to look at a bell curve, probably makes up the majority of that bell curve, right? Mm-hmm. Those are the people that, you know, that have struggled, that, you know, their relationships, marriages, friendships put to the test, their familial bonds, their interpersonal skills, their mental health, etc. That all has been put to the test, but no one hears about it because they just see the success at the end of the tunnels. Like, oh, wow, they worked 10 years and they got bought out by, you know, I'm not going to name names on the podcast, but say any big, tall, you know, big med tech company for $500 million. Congrats, you know?
Yeah.
But for me, it's the opposite. I don't want to hide my story because I think people that I'm mentoring and other entrepreneurs need to understand that there is, it's truly high risk, high reward.
It is.
What are you willing to risk for the potential of a reward? It's not even a guaranteed reward, right? And for me, this was the path that I wanted to go down regardless, right? Now, did I anticipate having COVID, supply chain issues, inflation, and all this stuff? God, no. Mm-hmm. No one ever, you know, predicted that. But am I proud of the team for what we were able to do to get through all of that? 100% yes. Mm-hmm. You know, I can't wish for a better team. I can't wish for a better support system, right? That through the ups and downs, And don't think that, you know, the support system was like all gung-ho about it from the beginning. It requires that communication, right? Mm-hmm. But having that there, I think, really played a critical role in where we are today.
Yep, yep. The other thing that you mentioned, talking about using, you know, early stage concepts, prototypes, et cetera, depending, you know, regardless of kind of the stage, whether it's alpha, whether it's beta, et cetera, for your clinical, you know, your early, you know, clinical studies, it reminded me of something that Dr. Scott Wolf mentioned on the pod. Gosh, this is probably a couple years ago, but he's the founder of Cool Sculpting. His latest company is Aaron Medical. These were his words, and I'm paraphrasing, but he was like, Scott, so many entrepreneurs make this mistake of like, they go into clinical studies thinking their generator needs to be perfect and the packaging needs to look pretty. And he's like, you wouldn't believe, and this is a guy, you know, that's been there, done that, right? He's like, for our studies with Aaron, he's like, we were lugging around this big, ugly looking box thing to our clinical sites. And I think that's one of those, things where it's like, it feels uncomfortable, like taking this thing into using it on a patient, and it's like, looks super ugly. And people are like, what is that thing? It's like, well, that's part of the deal, right? With startups. It's not going to look, as long as it works and it's safe. That's it.
That's why I said ethical and legal. As long as it's safe, it won't harm the patient. And you're just validating that the data is, you know, reproducible, repeatable, or whatever you need from that data. Yeah, man, there's no point in wasting so much time, you know, trying to make it perfect, because it will never be perfect. I can't tell you how many times we have, you know, iterated and modified. And obviously with regulatory, you have to eventually freeze the design, but you can freeze it temporarily. And then again, as long as it's a, you know, an encasement or like a physical look, but the underlying technology doesn't change, your reg consultant can easily do a physical change, you know, documentation control, and be like, hey, here you go. You know, let's sign this. We tested it. It's not going to, you know, slip or contain any type of, you know, bacteria that we don't know in any kind of slip, you know, or slit or anything like that. Then, you know, you're good to go. I think, again, talk to your reg consultant. But ultimately, it's try to get it out there as fast as possible. Yep. I can't agree more than him as well.
Yep, no doubt. And that phrase that you used earlier, if you're waiting for perfection, you're going to run out of money in that interim phase, right? You never reach it. So, really, really good point. Let's talk a little bit about funding a startup. Yep. I want to talk to you about non-dilutive funding first, and then maybe circle back around to equity-based financing. So, I've got it on my notes that you were maybe the youngest candidate or one of the youngest candidates to receive a phase one SBIR grant back in 2017, which that's pretty cool. I mean, I'm not sure if there's a Guinness Book of World Records for that, but that'd be pretty cool that, you know, if that was a plaque on the background there, right? in your office. But what's been, I mean, joking aside, I mean, incredible feat. A startup founder that's coming to UMN and saying, hey, look, Ahmed, I know you were really successful with non-dilutive funding. What are some tricks of the trade? What should I be thinking about? You know, what's your advice to them?
Yeah. So again, a little bit more on that perfection side, right? A lot of people think that you should put the most perfect first, you know, best foot forward on your SBIR application. Don't get me wrong. I don't think you should waste the time of the reviewers with a really, you know, bad and not well written. But if you think it's good enough, put that application in. I think that a lot of founders don't understand that, say, you know, there's three submission windows for the NIH. And I'm going to talk about NIH, talk a little bit about NSF I-Corps later on, because that's a program that we did for customer discovery. But for NIH, your timeline, if you submit in January, it gets reviewed in March. Council review doesn't start until June, potentially funding before September. You know, maybe around July to September range, you know, so January, we're in September, that's 9 months, you know, federal funding does not work as fast. And God knows if there's a continuing resolution or the government hasn't even passed the budget yet, don't even get me started on that. Right. So a lot of founders think, oh, I need to, you know, really flush out my thing. The same concept goes. The reviewers are going to tell you what they want to see. Right. You can only guess what they potentially want to see. Put in your application. Put in your application early. When I say early, I mean as soon as you can possibly. So if you're in right now, we are in February, right? The next application deadline is April 5th. If you already have all your government accounts set up, ready, and everything like that, then you should be working in the next 2 months now on preparing to submit in April, because April won't get reviewed until June. Council doesn't meet until August, September time. Any type of funding decision won't be made until the end of this year. But at least if you get your comments in by June, you will have the ability to, if let's say you don't get scored or you got scored, but it's a really high score, and high is bad in this case. So a lot of people watching this, the lower you are, the better. So 10 being the best, 90 being the worst. So when I say high score, I mean above funding line. I'm not going to tell you what the funding line is right now, but each institute has their own funding line, what score you kind of need to make. So if your score is relatively high, well, hey, guess what? you now have the opportunity to submit in September because your summary statement is going to be released. You're going to be able to get all that comments. So personally for me, I think if you have a working tech, you have an understanding of what you want to do testing wise, whether it's animal studies or whatever, put that up together, really talk well about it. And there's a lot of NIH programs like I think it's AAP that help people. What's it called? You can fact check me on the name of the program. But there's a lot of programs that help people learn how to submit SBIRs. Now, don't quote me, but I'm pretty sure you have to have failed submitting the first one in order to qualify for this 10-week program. But it does happen during summer. Again, you guys can search up the it's called the SEED or NIH SEED. .gov, I believe, and they have a list of all the resources that they offer. But put in that application, you know, utilize as many of the resources as possible. Now, the thing is, for me personally, is I don't kind of take no for an answer, especially with, you know, when I'm like relatively close to getting funding. So the story that I have with my first grant that we got is it was supposed to go to a specific entity. And I spoke with that entity program officer and they were like, we don't know. It's a little bit on the cusp of the funding zone. And I went and contacted a different entity and I'm like, hey, I see that your guys are listed on our grant. Would you guys like this grant? And they were really interested in it. Mm-hmm. So the process of having another entity potentially be interested in your grant could potentially expedite the grant approval process or at least the transfer process. So a lot of people like, you know, you might get like a 30, which generally is a relatively good score, but the institute that you're applying for might have a funding cap of you need to meet a score of a 25. Well, there's other institutes that are listed on your grant. Mm. Contact them, talk to them, say, hey, would you guys be interested in potentially funding this grant application? Don't just take that initial no as an answer. Do a little bit more work, figure it out, see if it really is a hard no. And if it is, okay, resubmit and try to get it on your next submission. But with grant funding, that's my tips and tricks is that you have to submit as soon as you can, because again, the funding cycles are anywhere between 9 to 12 months, depending on whether the government has, you know, a budget in place. And you never know who you might get because the review groups change every single time. Right. So if you're waiting for that perfect application, you toss it in and it gets not discussed, and then you submit it again and then it gets a different review group and they didn't agree with the previous review group, you know, you might as well try to figure all of that out as soon as possible. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's my biggest advice that I can give to any MedTech CEO. Now, granted, I didn't speak about NSF. NSF has a different program. They have a pitching to the NSF and then you're invited to apply. NSF, from what I've heard, is relatively quick with their funding decisions if they like the project. I have not personally gone through that process, but I've seen a lot of companies that I've advised go through it. If they like your project, they hit you back up relatively quickly. Again, whether it's guaranteed or not, that's between you and your program officer.
Got it. I love the grit, right? That mentality. Even when he applied to the world of like non-dilutive of funding and grant submissions, is like just basically ship, in this case, it's your application, right? And if you get a no, make sure it's a hard no, right?
Yeah. make sure you're not you know, disregarding other entities. I mean, mm-hmm. like there's, again, with NIH, there's so many institutes. That's why it's called the National Institutes of Health, right? You could have a product that you really thought was going to go into the diabetes division, but it also is applicable to, you know, the bioengineering or the dental or whatever, right? If the diabetes division doesn't want it or doesn't have, it's not within their funding line, but you dental and dental says, oh yeah, we're funding anything, you know, 35 and below. Hey, what do you guys think about our application? Now, the second battle will be, even though it applies to them, whether it's on their, you know, funding parameters that they're really looking for projects that fit within their funding needs, that's a different question. But at least now you know there's a potential second institute or even third institute that could potentially come in and fund this grant, right? Yeah. And that's why for me, what I tell a lot of the startups that I mentor and that I've seen is go online. There's, I can't remember the website, but NIH has a program that you can type in like a quick summary of your product and it will tell you which institutes you potentially fall under, right? So in your grant application, you can request for follow-on institutes to be targeted as primary or secondary. So don't want to go into too deep into it, but there are ways and there are techniques, and the only way to learn about them is, you know, either talk to somebody like me or go out there and figure it yourself out. And that's what I did.
Got it. And we'll definitely find that resource and link to it in the full write-up on MedCider. Yeah. But Ahmed, if I'm a CEO or founder of a startup, and I just heard you explain that, or like, and I'm leaning in, but I'm like, this sounds overwhelming. I have nowhere to start. Would you recommend they go to like one of these, you know, publicly available, you know, resources, or go to an agency that specializes in grant writing? What's your take on that?
So I'm going to speak on both sides. So in the beginning, we didn't use any grant writing agencies, and then we ended up using some for some other applications. It's not a guarantee, right? I just want to make that 100%, you know, out there. Grant writers can never guarantee that the grant that they help you write is going to get funded. Now, if they know your space and all that, maybe you have a high likeliness of getting a score, right? I've had a lot of friends that have gone through grant writing organizations, not discussed. And again, that's the issue with the review process, right? Is that you're getting different reviewers every single time. It's not like it's the same person reviewing your application. Actually, the scientific research officers, the SROs, make it a priority to not reassign. Now, this is from what I heard. To not reassign, even if the reviewers that reviewed your application prior in the previous cycle are in the same panel, they make it a priority to not give it back to those same reviewers and to give it to a different group of reviewers as your three primary reviewers. So all these changes, you know, if you're a bootstrap startup, unfortunately, you know, tossing in money into grant writing, I think your money can be spent better elsewhere. Hmm. However, if the grant writing is like, oh, it's contingency based, we base it off of like the success fee and it's built into the profit fee that you get out of the grant, hey, talk to your team about it. You know, I think anything success fee based, personally, I gear towards that more than shelling out money out of pocket, especially from startups that don't have the money. If it's a success fee and it's a reasonable success fee, normally it's like, I think 4-7%. Now, granted, it's not 4-7% of the total grant price. It's some companies will say, oh, we'll take the 7% fee that you build into your budget. So sometimes that 7% fee could be like a $8,000 to $13,000-$14,000 that the NIH will allow you to put in there. And some companies will say, no, we want an X percent of the total awarded value. With respect to that, you should work with your team and talk to your team about, hey, is this, you know, they're asking for 5%. This is a $300,000 grant. You know, are we really about to do, you know, 15,000 or whatever? Mm-hmm. That's between you and your team, right? But if they're really good, most of the times they don't charge you up front. Now, trust me, I know some really, really good firms that will charge you, but those are firms normally for people that have the money and are ready to go down that pathway to where they can, you know, throw out tons of grants for you, right? But personally, I think every startup CEO and startup founder team should all work on writing a grant by themselves first. The NIH has a ton of grants that are available online. Some of them are obviously redacted, but you can kind of see how other people write their grants, mm-hmm. right? And I think that's really important for you as a founder, you as a CEO, to really understand what goes into grant writing before you hire a grant writer. Yep. Because grant writers are only as good as the information that you give them. And if you don't have any good information, they can't pull things out of thin air. You know what I mean? They need some form of background data and information. And you can't just bombard them with a ton of stuff because they're going to spend a ton of hours. They're going to bill you for it to understand what they're going to present. Yep. You know?
Yep. Good stuff. And I want to carve out enough time for the rapid fire portion of this interview, but on the flip side of that coin is equity-based financing. And I think you raised, I think, a seed round, gosh, you know, what was it, back in 2021?
It was when we got our FDA clearance. So okay. 2021. And then we've raised a bridge past that. So about 3.2, 3.3 million to date, I think.
Got it. When you think about what's worked for you with equity-based financing versus maybe even what's not, and maybe the better way to frame this up is if you were going to open up a round right now, you know, is there anything that you do differently versus, you know, previous experiences?
So, you know, from my experience, and I'll make this really nice, sweet, and simple, it's truly setting up a game plan of who you want to target from the investor's perspective, which VC and or investor will be the best partner for you, and really build out those connections. So like for me, this is my first company, right? I don't have a Rolodex of investors and angels and people that I could just like, hey, yeah, man, I started a company. Mm-hmm. I graduated from UCI. Why don't you come on in? No, it's through your network, right? Like sometimes from your co-founders, and they have friend and family that can come in and do all like that. So for any, you know, aspiring med tech or any CEO or startup founder in general, you know, people think, oh yeah, my idea will sell itself. VCs don't work like that. A lot of VCs, and I'm respecting the ones that are coming out more with like these office hour type, like get to know us kind of fund. I respect them a lot because founders can go to them and say like, hey, if I were hypothetically to come to you, right? Because the analyst or whoever you're talking with is not judging your product or anything. If I were to come to you and ask you like, hey, what do you guys expect as a return? Because obviously VCs are in for the return on investment, right? Some have social impact, et cetera, but truly at the bare bones of it, they want their return. Some VCs will tell you, we want our whole entire fund back. So if you were to come to them and ask them for $100,000, but their fund size is 100 million, do you really think that $100,000 is going to bring them back? Let's be honest, the likelihood that their $100,000 investment is to bring them back 100 million, it's out of this world, right? Mm-hmm. So startups need to understand what the needs and wants are from the VCs, right? And then show that through your pitch. Hey, we're raising, let's just make the math easy, right? Say that the company, that the fund had a $10 million fund, right? We're raising $1 million and we're hoping to, you know, we're looking to exit for $100 million, right? So they're 1 million at a 10% of the company. Hey, if it gets bought out for 100 million, we made back our $10 million fund. Now every other startup is just multiple plays at that 10 million. But some other VCs are completely different. They're just looking at a X multiple of the money that they put in, mm-hmm. right? So you have to really understand the VC game. You have to really, you know, plan out who do you want to target? Are you even VC backable, right? You know, a lot of this kind of goes under the radar. It's like, oh yeah, you know, I'm not getting any venture funding. No one likes my idea. It's like, what's your market size? Oh yeah, our SAM is like 20 million. You know, it's like, so what's your, like, what are you, like, own the market within 3 years? Like, look, realistically, VCs are looking at multiple billion-dollar market size, mm-hmm. because they want somebody to come in, whoever they invest in, and say, hey, we're going to take a small sliver, but our small sliver is going to end up being worth a couple $100 million, yep. right? Whereas if people are like, yeah, the TAM of my market is 50 million, you're not VC backable, you know? Yep. So talk to the VCs, talk early on, go to networking events, travel if you must, and really understand their investment focus and their investment criterias. And then work your way backwards. So that's personally for me, I thought build it and they will come. But in reality, it's understand what they will come to first and then build that, right? Mm-hmm. So get to know your audience. And no matter what, this is the same theme across the board. Get to know your users, get to know the regulatory pathway, get to know your grant funding pathway, and get to know the people that you're going to ask money from. Mm-hmm. What are they looking for? You know, I could tell you my angels are just looking for a societal benefit and they just want their money back, right? Mm-hmm. Just give me back exactly what I put in. Or they might say, I want 5X return on my investment. Okay, I understand what my customers, right, my partners want, right? A lot of startups don't do that. They just kind of build out the deck and they go and, you know, bombard VCs sometimes and they expect, you know, like, oh, why aren't we getting funding? you really have to break it down and truly understand who your customer is, because VCs are your customers too. You're selling them a product. You're selling them an idea. You're selling them a piece of your company.
Yeah.
So you need to definitely know what they want and how they want it to be presented to them.
All really, really good points. I'm looking at the clock and I know we're a little bit short on time. So I'd love to get to the rapid fire portion of this interview. But for those, again, that are listening that don't get a chance to get to the full write-up on MedCider, centerhealth.com is the URL for Ahmed's company. Center is S-Y-N-T-R. S-Y-N-T-R. So centerhealth.com. We'll link to that as well as Ahmed's LinkedIn profile in the full write-up on MedCider. So Ahmed, these questions are rapid fire in nature. If you want to expound a little bit on the answers, feel free. But the first one on the docket is, when you look at the next 12 months, right? So take us through the end of 24. What are you most excited about at Center?
So personally for me, we're excited about getting our product out there more. We're signing on more clinicians. We're signing on more customers. Getting our product into their hands and into various use cases. So, you know, based off of our FDA clearance, we're cleared for over 11 surgical specialties today. So very, very broad indication. And we're just trying to get into the hands of many clinicians as possible. We're also growing our network of key opinion leaders on our board of advisors. So the next 12 months, hustling and bustling, and hopefully trying to close this round of funding as fast as possible to really put that money to work and grow our market share.
Awesome. All right. Since starting the company, 7-8 years ago, what's the most surprising thing that you've learned?
The most surprising thing is, I think the biggest thing for me is needing to stand out and not following the status quo. So many people talk to you and they say, well, you got to follow the status quo. Like Scott and I discussed, you got to do that pre-sub. You got to, put your bet. That's the biggest thing that I see actually killing startups, right? Especially in the med tech space. With respect to apps and stuff, you can put up your best, product and then have, the feedback that you get from your clients relatively quickly. In the med device world, you don't really have that. So for me, it's how soon to bring on clinicians. I think through NSF I-Corps or even NIH I-Corps. NSF I-Corps doesn't require a grant, so you guys should look into it. It's customer discovery. You get funding to go and interview doctors, clinicians, doing all that. We learned early on what our clinicians needed, and we focused on that. We kind of pushed aside all these, I don't want to call them advisors, but, these people that say that they know the market and they just want to give you their advice. Don't take advice from somebody that's not willing to put up the money, to match that advice, is my personal opinion. So that was the biggest thing. The most surprising is that you really need to know how to weed out the BS versus the good things that you need to take in and implement into your company and really help you push that forward.
Got it. Good stuff. I know you advise and mentor a lot of startups, as you've referenced here in the conversation. But if you had a room full of entrepreneurs, let's say we're down in the OC, and there's one piece of thing that you really want to drill home, or you want to make sure they fully understand, what would that be?
The biggest thing, and I've done a few lectures for a good buddy of mine at UCI, and he has a bunch of students that look into this. The one key lesson that I always try to hammer home is that this is not easy. Be sure that you're ready for this challenge, this pathway, but understand that you have a group of entrepreneurs like myself, and there's a ton out there. We're here to help each other. My biggest goal is to create, this amazing network of entrepreneurs to lift each other up. But you can't do it alone. I've done it. I've been there, but it's hell. So I wouldn't recommend doing it alone from my own personal experience. But don't be afraid to ask for help. Don't be afraid to extend a helping hand, because you never know what might come back to you. So that would be the biggest thing. It's not easy, but there's people out there to help you. And don't be afraid to help other people too, right? Obviously, don't commit hours and hours of your time into their companies, etc., but help as much as you can and be open with the help as much as you can, because hopefully you'll receive help down the line. You never know. Maybe they go work at a VC and they say, hey man, I remembered you helped me out with my company. It failed, but I'm here ready to give it back to you. You know, those are how relationships are made.
Yep. Good stuff. All right. Last question on the docket. I know you've accomplished a lot in a relatively, you know, young career. So normally I say, you know, what would you tell yourself in your, you know, if you had to go back to your late 20s, but I'll say like maybe early 20s, right? Maybe you're, you know, you're kind of finishing up school at UCI. Is there anything you tell yourself, you know, to do differently, I guess, from a professional standpoint?
So, you know, no matter what, I wouldn't tell myself to not go down this pathway. I would tell him to go down this pathway. And yeah, you're right. It's early 20s. I think 22 years old when I started this thing. Uh-huh. God, man, it's crazy looking back. My 20s have been put into this company. But the biggest thing I would tell myself is do everything that you're doing right now. Think the way that you think right now. The biggest advice that I would give, though, is plan early on. Because when I first started this company with my guys, you know, we focused purely on that federal side rather than on the investment side. We were like, yeah, we could probably get this thing fully, you know, funded by non-dilutive. But, you know, going through it, you know, you kind of grow as a person. You understand that there's no way in hell federal funding can just purely commercialize, you know, a product. Maybe drugs, because, you know, you can get tons of money to test out drugs in clinical settings. Med device is limited, right? Mm. So I would tell myself to start early on thinking about who the right investors are, what the right resources are to go to those investors, creating a list, making sure that you have the right techniques to, you know, keep those investors in the loop of what's going on. And I tell this to everybody as well, is even if an investor might not invest, right? Include them on your, you know, if you're doing a quarterly update or, you know, every 2 months update, just include them. Mm-hmm. Just include them. Hey guys, this is what's new with, you know, with your company X today, right? We have acquired, you know, 10 new customers. We're about to do that. Because I've done it too. I've included the people that say, hey, yeah, no, not too early, whatever. Keep us in the loop. I put them into our investor update. And then sometimes I get back, hey, we looked over it again. It's still a little bit too early. I'm like, hey, cool. I didn't have to waste directly emailing you, you know, and talking and try to sell it. Just through my investor email updates, you're able to see what's going on, and you're able to make it yourself a, hey, we should hit up Sinter and let them know. Yes, no, maybe so, from their own side without me having to sell it. So I think that's what I would do.
Yeah, that's good stuff. Good way to wrap up the conversation. Ahmed, thanks a ton for doing the interview. Really, really appreciate it. Thank Again, you. For everyone listening, centerhealth.com is the website, S-Y-N-T-R health, centerhealth.com. We'll link to it in the full write-up that summarizes this conversation and kind of really bring you know, surfaces a lot of the key insights that Ahmed shared throughout the course of this conversation. We'll link to that as well as Ahmed's LinkedIn profile there too. But again, can't thank you enough for coming on the program. Yeah,
lots of
really, really good insights, you know, that you dropped. You know, I can tell a lot of them will probably hit home to a lot of folks that are in the same boat. So thanks again for everyone listening. You made it this far. Appreciate your attention as always. Until the next episode of MedSider goes live, everyone, take care. Hey, it's Scott again. One quick thing before you go. You see, I love bringing you insightful conversations with the best founders and CEOs of medical device and health technology startups. But here's the thing. I'd be super grateful if you could help me reach even more ambitious doers who share our passion. So if you found value in this podcast, if you found yourself nodding your head while listening, or if you simply enjoy what we're doing with MedSider, please take a moment to leave us a review. It's super easy. Just open your Apple Podcast app or the podcast app of your choice, search for our show, and scroll down to the ratings and reviews section. Leave your honest thoughts and hit that 5-star rating if you think we're worthy. Your feedback is incredibly important, and it's the best way to ensure we keep bringing you awesome discussions with leading founders and CEOs. So take a moment to be a good friend and leave that review today. As always, thanks for being a part of our journey and for helping MedSider continue to grow and evolve. Your support is greatly appreciated. All right, enough talk about reviews. Stay tuned for another informative episode coming at you soon.